Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Rick Kaler has been helping people get right with their finances for decades. He's founder of Kaler Financial Group in Rapid City and the author of several financial therapy books, including Wired for Wealth. I spoke with him yesterday when he stopped by the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Rapid City studio. As part of our ongoing financial therapy conversations, you can find the entire series on our website at listen.sdpb.org. Today, we started by talking about money disorders.
A money disorder or a problematic money behavior is a behavior that is probably causing stress or some type of pain in somebody's life. And it's typically the result of some type of trauma or some type of drama that has happened in a person's life. And traumas and dramas don't have to be. When the first time I ever heard that, I thought, well, this must have to be something really big and really hurtful. And it doesn't. It's anything that is hurtful or something that is disturbing to someone. And so you can have light traumas, you can have heavy traumas, like a death or a car accident or something like that. And the depth of how that's going to affect somebody is how they view that, you know, in the past, and how often that happens, if it's just once or if it's repeated every day in a person's life. So that's kind of the start of a money disorder.
We must all have them. I can't imagine that any human being gets off a free pass from having some kind of money drama or trauma in their past.
Absolutely not. Everybody has them, and your kids are going to have them regardless of how judicious you are, how intentional you are in trying to help them grow and mature in a mature way. There's no way to avoid it.
So you begin not with the question of do I have any problematic behaviors, do I have any money, but more along the line of saying how do you sort of start finding your own uncovering those disorders?
Yeah. Well, you know, last time we talked about the money scripts.
Right.
And that can start giving a clue. For example, we talked about how one of my money scripts is you've got to work hard for money. The resulting disorder that often comes from that money script is workaholism. Mm. And workaholism is one of the disorders, and a disorder can be found in part or in whole in something called the DSM-5. And the DSM-5 is the Bible of the mental health profession as far as diagnosis. And there's a lot of debate over within the mental health profession about the DSM-5, if it's there's some practitioners that will go by it and some practitioners that will actually kind of put it aside because they don't want to diagnose people. They want to help people. Nevertheless, there's five of these disorders that can kind of be found in there, workaholism being one of them. And that's been my drug of choice.
Hmm. Are you fighting it forever? Do you ever get to the point if you have, you know, you're very clear about saying, you know, that's something in my life, are you always sort of dealing with that particular disorder?
I think there can always be a sensitivity to that because of the hardwiring, but the good news is that the brain can be rewired. And when I use the word drug of choice, I use that very intentionally because typically, say a drug used recreationally or like alcohol is often used in a manner to mask pain as a way to escape. And so anytime we are running from emotional pain, and we may not even know that we're running from it, that's an avoidance mechanism. And so for me, work, I remember working 80 hours a week. You know, that was what was my relationship. Because of that, it was a contributing reason to my marriage falling apart. And I was, once I started doing some work on myself, paying attention to what was going on with myself, I could see, oh, I go to work when I'm starting to feel uncomfortable with feelings or with situations. So today, I'm really not aware of when I'm working that I'm there avoiding pain or avoiding feeling something emotional. I think the problem that I personally have is I have constructed so much of my work to be play, which means around something that I really love, is it's hard for me sometimes to know if I'm working or if I'm playing.
Yeah.
And I really like to play.
I was going to ask you this question as soon as this weekend. So, you know, I've had a difficult weekend, not because anything bad happened, just a lot of work. And Sunday I find myself in the bookstore, which is where I go when I'm feeling uncomfortable and when I'm happy and when it's Tuesday. There's all these different reasons that I go and buy books. And when I was done, I just felt better. And it was that feeling of betterness that made me, that was almost a red flag, that I said, oh, okay, I feel better. Well, how was I feeling before? Was I feeling stressed out? And buying this little stack of books suddenly relieved me of something, made me, after our conversations, pay attention more to what was that behavior about. And that's my question for you is, well, reading and you know, going to the bookstore are good things. Going to work is a good thing. When do you know that you're doing this behavior that it's unhealthy, and when do you know that it's just a healthy part of who you are?
Yeah, I think the bottom line is, what was I feeling right before that activity? And whether it's reading a book, whether it's checking my texts, whether it's watching TV, whether it's having a drink, or whatever the activity is, if I can trace back and say, oh, I was feeling some real anger, some fear, a lot of stress, sadness, hurt, or some difficult emotion, then probably the activity was some type of a medicating activity. Because none of us enjoy feeling difficult feelings. I mean, most of us spend a lifetime resisting these, telling these feelings they don't belong within us, trying to get rid of them, trying to overcome them. And what we're finding is the real relief comes just from the opposite of what we're doing. The relief comes from turning toward and embracing that really difficult feeling and experiencing it and feeling it. Then we get to the lightness.
Let's talk about the impact of not doing that. So in my case, if I'm at the bookstore and I'm buying a stack of books and I'm putting them on my credit card, then that is overspending, or it could be contributing. And in your case, if you're a workaholic and, you know, that could be useful for you financially, but detrimental to your relationships. What are some of the impacts of untreated, unrecognized, and undealt with money disorders?
Let me count the ways.
Right?
I mean, about unlimited.
Yeah.
You bring up an excellent, excellent correlation, which I turn toward books. The monetary position consequence is I'm buying books, I'm putting them on my credit card, and I have maybe a nightstand full of 30 books that I haven't read. I've heard of people do the same thing with clothes. I had a client once that took a little eval, and she looked at this. She says, I can't believe this. I have spent, I think it was $20,000 or $30,000 this year on clothes. My closet is stuffed with clothes I haven't worn, and I'm grieving because she had just lost her husband, and very suddenly. And she was able to put this together about a year later. And so this is how oftentimes we turn toward spending to console ourselves, to avoid, in this case, for her, it was deep grief, just the deep grieving process. And this is so common, so normal for this to be underlying what a spending problem is. And this is why we say it's not about the money.
Yeah. Why clothes for her and books for someone else? Is there a hint or a clue to what's going on underneath based on how it manifests itself?
I don't think so. For her, she enjoyed clothes. For somebody like yourself that enjoys reading, it isn't that. I mean, reading could be a great
thing. Yeah.
You know? And so I think what you bring out is a really nice and insightful nuance is that one person's medicator is another person's pure enjoyment or fulfillment. And I would bet if there was some type of difficult feeling that was spurring the reading, if those feelings were felt and embraced, it may not mean that you quit reading.
Well, let's hope not. But, you know, with this comparison, it's really useful. You can't quit working, and she can't quit wearing clothes, or she can't limit herself to, you know, two pairs of pants or whatever. So that gets to this idea when your behavior is something that is part of either something you enjoy as well or something you have to do, but you need to do it better and more effectively. It's not quite like quitting smoking where you can never touch a cigarette again, in theory. I've never had to try that. But that seems to be a clarity. I failed or I succeeded today based on whether I had that cigarette. But if you're at work or if you, you know, bought a book that you needed for work or, you know, how do you know when you're justifying and how do you know when, yep, that was a good decision. Yeah.
And you have the same problem with overeating.
Right. Yeah.
It's not
right.
You can't eat without food. Right. And, I think simplistically, it goes back to what was my motivation? What's my motivation? I was talking with somebody over Mother's Day, and she had received some chocolates from her kids. And she had said, you know, I had a pet die today, and I ate the rest of the box of chocolates. Mm. Okay, so there's a definite connection of I was having a difficult feeling, and so I turned toward food to medicate or console myself. Whereas, I've just had a nice meal. I'd like some dessert. I think I'm going to eat one of those chocolates. Totally different motivations for each one. So, and the key is once we can really be aware, we can get aware. Like you said, you've started to pay attention to that. That's half the battle. It doesn't win the battle, but a lot of us aren't even aware that there is a difficult feeling going on.
Right. And I can even feel sometimes when we talk, my own resistance come up. And part of it is coming from this idea that when you say, what were you feeling right before you did this behavior? Well, I was in a spot where I didn't know what else to do. And so how do people get to the point where now that you're noticing and you're seeing how the behavior is affecting your life and the pet has died and you're grieving, it seems harmless to eat the box of chocolate if you know, you're aware of it, but there has to be a better way. How do you deal with the grieving in a healthier way? How do we find the tools to deal with the emotional difficulty of life in a way that is not unhealthy for us or other people?
Yeah, it sounds so simplistic, but it's like feel the feeling.
Yeah.
And that can be so hard. I remember having this aha a couple of years ago that there's a difference between talking about a feeling and feeling the feeling. Mm. And I found out that I could talk about sadness. I could talk about, I'm feeling sad. But it's very hard for me to actually feel sad, to get to a place of tears, or to just be in the depth of that feeling. And I thought to myself, you know, I've been at this for 25, 30 years, and I never understood there's a difference between talking about it and feeling it. And then I'm cleaning out my bookshelf for some reason a few months later. I came across a book that I read early on in my path down this road of some call it recovery. And I looked at some highlighted areas, and I saw that I had highlighted a sentence that said, talking about a feeling is very different from feeling a feeling.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh, it took me 30 years to get that.
And then you found it in the book.
And then I found it that feels, I had read.
Yeah, that feels significant, doesn't it? It feels non-coincidental, depending on what your beliefs are.
Absolutely. So it really is a journey to become aware and to become conscious.
More with Rick Kaler after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with financial therapist Rick Kaler. We begin here by looking at other money disorders.
Some of the other disorders are compulsive buying. There's actually a name for that called onomania. There's gambling. There's hoarding, and there's financial dependence. So, and financial dependence is being dependent on anyone or any organization, or it could be a government, for us assistance. Mm. So those are the five disorders. And gambling and hoarding can be very common. Financial dependence is very common.
Right. What's the difference between overspending and compulsive buying?
They can be pretty close, but a compulsive buyer is somebody that's going to buy whether they need it or not. I mean, it is like almost there's compulsive shopping. It's not something we list as a disorder, but it maybe should be. And that's where somebody just shops. I mean, there's people that will spend 6 and 8 hours a day shopping, but they won't buy. Hmm. But again, it's that, what am I escaping from with this activity? And is it harming other relationships in my life? So the compulsive buying is just needing to buy. Okay. And I remember working with somebody who had like $50,000 of credit card debt, and inappropriately used her employer's credit card to buy things and hid things. And it was just so compulsive. And we tracked that back for her. It came back to when she was 16 years old and she wanted her dad's attention. And he traveled a lot and he would give her the credit card and say, here, go buy something and leave.
Yeah. Which, and if we could pause there so I could interject, when we talked about feeling the feelings, can you feel the feelings of something that happened back then? So let's go back to the beginning of this conversation where we talked about, you know, things that have happened to you, the traumas and dramas. Can you feel those feelings and get over something that happened when you were 15 or 16 once you start making those connections?
Yeah, absolutely. And the first thing that popped in mind was the story, the Christmas Carol, when Scrooge, the first ghost, took him into the past. And when you read the book, when he was shown scenes of his life, there were times that he trembled, it said, in fear, re-experiencing those feelings that had been shut down. And so what gets us into trouble as young kids We don't know how to deal with feelings. We're not encouraged to feel our feelings. In fact, quite the opposite. We're often encouraged to stuff those feelings. And those feelings remain stuffed until, if we ever revisit them, that they're revisited and allowed to really be felt. You might have seen shots of bears or animals being tranquilized, and maybe they're being chased by a helicopter. And when they come out of the trance, they'll begin running, even if they're on their back, as a way of working through this trauma. So it absolutely can happen, and I would go so far to say it absolutely needs to happen to really heal that incident in our life. It's a validation. When we stuff that feeling, we are invalidating ourselves. We're telling ourselves, this is wrong. There's a part of me that is messed up here and is wrong, and I've got to deny. And when we actually feel the feeling, we are affirming what happened. We're affirming the intensity. We're affirming ourselves as human beings in what happened. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really important.
When people come talk to you seeking financial therapy, how often do you really get to the event? I mean, what I'm wondering is, they kind of know already where it came from, or are you finding that for more people, it's, you know, things are buried so deeply that they just don't, like, I could not tell you right now where book buying and sort of the 30 books on the nightstand that I'll never have time. I mean, I have more books in my house that I could read in a lifetime. And I still want more, and I feel like I need more. Now, how do I begin to find out where that is even coming from? Because I couldn't tell you off the top of my head any time when, you know, there was any traumatic event around reading, for example.
Yeah, maybe you and I could save some money and go to therapy together. Okay. Because I have 30 books on my nightstand, which is where I got that. Yeah. However, you know, for myself, I'm not buying them because I'm in pain. I'm probably buying them because I have this overwhelming curiosity, and then I lie to myself that I'll really get the chance to read it.
That's what it feels like. Like, I want to know everything that's in there, and that's why I'm bringing home the book, and then I'm sad that I'm mortal and that I'll never get to them all, and there's more coming out. Yeah.
I would say most people that come to us are pretty clueless. Yeah. About where it's all come from. A lot of folks really think it's about the money, but it's pretty normal for all of us to be just not conscious about it. And we have people that come to us that are in on a continuum of awareness. A lot of people are in what we call pre-contemplation for change, which means the common word's denial.
Sure.
They don't even know they have a problem. So they'll come to us for one thing. It's like going to your doctor saying, I got a headache, and the doctor takes some x-rays and says, wow, there is a spot on your lungs that I'm concerned about. And it's like, no, I'm just concerned about the headache.
Can we go back?
That's what I came to you for, was the headache.
Yeah. Where does hoarding come from? As I'm thinking of the pile of 30 books, that could also make a person think of stockpiling and what that sort of provides people. What's hoarding? Where, you know, what's the background for hoarding as a money disorder?
You know, it can mean different things to different people. And that's the interesting part of what we do, is never make an assumption as to anything, as why it's happening. When I make an assumption is when I get myself in trouble. And to hang out and say, huh, that's curious. What? Tell me about the thought process that's behind that. For some people, it may be the lack or the fear of scarcity. You know, maybe when they were raised, there wasn't whatever they're hoarding. Which could be. There can be a number of causes, but I guarantee you, when you get to the root belief, the money script, behind that? Because there's a money script behind hoarding. There's a thought process behind hoarding. When we find out what that belief is, it becomes perfectly logical why a person would hoard.
Sure. All right, give me an example from obviously you can't talk about individual clients, but can you think of an example for someone whose hoarding revealed an interior logic that wasn't apparent at first?
Yeah, I think I'm thinking of someone that really hoarded clothes, and they would just hoard lots of everything because as a kid, they just didn't have anything. And if they got something, the distribution systems and the finances of the family were such that they could never be assured there would ever be another one. So as they matured as adult and they had a chance to buy, they were going to make sure that they would never run out of that. And things change, economies change. You know, you can get about anything with in 2 days,
right,
from anywhere in the country. But when we have that deep wounding or that trauma, the fear or the hurt or whatever is locked that in place, we just don't think that away. And that's where we come up with these seemingly irrational behaviors around money.
Oh, it's tough to be human, huh?
Yeah. It's quite an experience to be human.
That's quite an experience. How about gambling? That's never been, the very first time I ever did anything that would resemble gambling was my dad and I was 18, and we drove from South Dakota to Los Angeles, and we stayed in Las Vegas. And I remember winning in a slot machine like $80 in quarters, which is a big deal because the light went off and it was $80. And maybe it might have been $60. I mean, it wasn't, when I think about it, wasn't a lot of money, but it was the experience that all of a sudden. And then throughout the day we stayed, and that $60 in quarters kind of whittled down to not much. And I was so guilt-ridden that I hadn't walked away with a cup of quarters that I've never, I mean, it just turned me off of gambling forever. I won't even put a dollar into a machine today. Other people would have had an entirely different reaction to that experience. So is there something chemical going on here with gambling as well, and why some person would be attracted to that sort of chemical brain hit and someone else would be repelled by it?
Yeah, I think the same chemical thing is going on as for the same reason that somebody would spend $6,000 for a vacation rather than fund their IRA with it. 90% of all financial decisions are made emotionally in the limbic system. So I like to say whichever decision has the greatest emotional juice or impact is usually the winner. So take gambling. There can be, I think of three responses to gamblings or to gambling or three reasons. The first one is what you laid out, which is actually somewhat of my, the way I approach gambling, is that I remember going and losing $10 at the blackjack tables in Deadwood, and it just ruined my night.
Yeah, that's what I'm like.
I could have had a nice meal.
I could have bought a book. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and so that has a lot of emotional juice because there were chemicals released, and we're like, not doing that again. No. Where on the other hand, there is the person that can look at that and it's entertainment. I had a great night. I lost $50. I had fun gambling. Actually, one of my mentor in financial planning was that way. Yeah. Love blackjack. Yeah. And then you can have the third person that is getting a big emotional hit. The emotional adrenaline is escaping from a difficult feeling. And it's like reading the book. I feel so much better. Well, I feel so much better when I'm gambling. Wow, this is great. You know, this is the typical addictive cycle. Right. And that can, you know, where the entertainment person isn't going to lose more than they can afford to lose, where you and I aren't going to lose anything, the gambler is going to lose what they cannot afford to lose. Yeah.
Financial dependency. You mentioned that can be on other people, that can be in a family, that could be, you know, from a policy standpoint on federal assistance. Expand on that a little bit, please.
Yeah, dependency really kills our self-esteem and makes us less than with people. It really minimizes us and disempowers us. So, whereas financial independence is the total opposite. It's where we step into ourselves. We're empowered. We have a voice. We are responsible, and that hugely builds self-esteem. So financial dependence, the big thing that I often see there is enabling. And, you know, that's pretty common. And a lot of enabling comes from guilt, especially parental guilt.
Yeah.
So it can be harmful. It can be harmful for both parties, for the giver who may be hurting themselves financially in enabling a child or anybody, and then for the recipient to be building that financial dependence. And the lack of self-esteem and the lack of skills and just the financial harm that can come from being provided for.
Any final thoughts on, you know, once people get an idea that these money disorders and this problematic behavior exists and, you know, it can be dealt with, what else do you want to say about moving forward to healthier places?
Well, like everything, it kind of sounds like a broken record. Becoming aware is the first step. And once we start becoming aware of those disorders, and again, I want to say, not beating ourselves up for having disorders. All of us have a disorder or problematic behavior in some form or fashion. Of course, all of us have money scripts. There's nobody who's 100, there's no such thing as 100% healthy around money. So the first thing is just to understand, yes, I have this disorder, and it's not a sentence, it's not a life sentence, it's not terminal. There's steps that we can start to take to address any disorder or problematic behavior. And it may not be a fun path. It may not happen quickly. Sometimes it takes some hard and usually emotional work. Usually the emotional work has to come before the financial work happens.
You are unafraid to take the next step to your own journey as well as helping other people on theirs. Do you enjoy the process of always, you know, being in tune with how you could be better? I mean, is this something that sort of nourishes you, or is it, you know, because I could also see people saying, like, I always feel like I have to be doing the next thing to fix myself. How do you approach that lifelong learning mentality?
Yeah, that's a tough one, because part of my personality can be to be fixing myself, which in and of itself sounds admirable, but it can come from not such a great place. And yet, a path of self-growth, it's really never over. And is it something I look forward to? It kind of depends. You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I don't know, I'm sure you've heard of Brené Brown.
Right.
And she is she makes vulnerability sound so cool.
So attractive. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I want to be vulnerable. Yeah. until I'm there and I'm like, who came up with this idea? This sucks. Yeah. This is not fun. I mean, I try to have transparency in our workplace. And there's been more than one time that I'm like, who came up with this idea? Can't we all just sweep this stuff under the rug and pretend that we get along? I mean, this transparency is for the birds. So, no, it's often embracing those difficult feelings is not easy at all. And growth is often has its moments of real pain and being real scary. And it's important, I guess, once a person's kind of been through that and come out on the other side and experience the benefits. It gives you a little more courage to get back in the next time.
Yeah, then you can start realizing that having money can be fun and empowering and all the positive things that can come from making the right choices for yourself and for those around you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Money can support it, and we can begin to have our money serve us rather than us serve our money.
Mm. Rick Kaler, thank you so much for being here with us today. As always, we appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.